So we got our office next door to her. And this Mrs. William Kent, whom at that time I hadn't met, but I went to see later, she gave the first $5 and said, I'll give $5 every mm-hmm. month. And so then we thought, well, with $5 guaranteed, maybe we could raise the 55,
mm-hmm.
because we were so impressed upon us by the national headquarters that we couldn't send them let any bill, unpaid bill ever go to them.
Yeah.
So we didn't take it then, but we thought we probably would. Well, then I went to see Mrs. Helen Gardner, who was on their list, and she was very cooperative, and she'd been, I think she was a writer of some type. I think she was very displeased that a young whippersnapper such as myself should be the chairman, because mm. she talked about, well, they don't have much sense about people they put in charge of all these undertakings which need great experience and so on. I think she probably thought she should have been made the chairman, but nobody had known, I suppose, that she wouldn't even think of it. So we sat in this room, and finally I said, if we do start off this procession, since you are in the field of journalism, would you be willing to be our press chairman? And she said, yes, she certainly would. So we gradually got this way some people. And then I went to see the president of the little group in Washington, which was very tiny, and her name was Florence Etheridge. And she was employed in the Indian Bureau in Washington. And I met her at the National Convention in Philadelphia because she'd come down to represent her little D.C. group at that convention. And she'd known that up there we talked about the possibility of having a procession the day before Wilson came in.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted very much to do it, but she said it was just impossible. We couldn't vote to do it at the convention because we had nobody to get it up and no money with which to get it up. So we said, well, I think it would be a good idea. I don't know whether it's possible. So then she took me to see Mrs. William Kent, my predecessor.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And I put her off because I wanted to get a little foothold before I went to her, because she'd be the most important. And there I found such a wonderful welcome and such a marvelous woman. Roger Kent's mother, you know.
Oh, yes. Yes, I know.
Beyond words, a wonderful person. She's wonderful. So she invited me immediately to come and have Christmas dinner with them. Mm-hmm. And knowing our possibility of getting a little headquarters, she said she would give the $5 every month. And she was from that time on a steadfast supporter until when she died. She was still a member of our board when she died.
Yeah.
Not so long ago.
Yes, that $5 a month.
So then when we got...
Started a tradition with her, didn't it? Because I noticed through
the books... She kept on and on giving all.
She'd have a committee of 100 and a committee of 200. Always pay your rent as your houses got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Oh, it was wonderful what she did. But then we decided to have a meeting and launch it, the whole program. So we held a meeting on the 2nd of January, which was the first meeting we ever held in Washington.
Hmm.
And I suppose it was held in this new little headquarters, though I'm not quite sure.
Hmm. You got a telephone call.
All right. Now, this first meeting, I presided and introduced the whole idea of a procession and so on. And I remember everybody there supported the idea and said they would turn in and help. And I remember among the people who were there was this Miss Belva Lockwood. Did you ever hear of her?
Belva Lockwood?
Belva Lockwood.
Oh, no.
I think she's the first woman in the country who ever ran seriously for the presidency. And she was the woman who single-handed opened the Supreme Court to women.
Bellevue Lockwood?
B-E-L-V-A, Belva.
Oh.
L-O-C-K-W-W-D, Lockwood.
Okay.
She was one of the pioneers, and she died, of course, a good many years ago. But it was very nice. She came and she sort of gave us her blessing. It was and of course, Mrs. William Kent came, and Miss Helen Gardner, and all these few people we'd gotten in touch with. Among other people that I haven't told you about, that I went to see one after another. The one that I suppose, was the most important where I went to see, but I didn't know it then, was Elsie Hill. She was the daughter of, as I told you, Congressman Hill. She was on my list.
And he was Congressman Hill from what state?
Connecticut, and from the district we're sitting in now.
Oh.
It's for this, our district. He was 19 years in Congress, and on all the, and on very important committees. And his daughter, who graduated Vassar, had gone over and spent some time in France, and knew a little about French. So she wanted to stay on in Washington after she finished college to be with her family. She got a position to teach French in the high school in Washington. And when I met her, she was teaching French, going off every morning, coming back about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, I guess. And I remember so vividly going around, she'd taken an apartment of her own, and my goodness, I remember that interview so well. And she was so lovely and so enthusiastic, and she would bring in her whole college suffrage league into our march.
Oh.
And from that very, I guess never a day from that time until she died, we didn't work together over something. Whatever we were working on, we worked together. As I said, then she came in and stayed with me after my sister died up here.
Mm-hmm.
And all that china you were asking about, it's in the left-hand side, we call our common cupboard. She bought almost all that china.
Mm-hmm.
And I paid for the things, but she went out and bought them and stocked me with everything I needed to have. And she got that little radio.
Mm.
A man stopped at the door, and I said, I just think I can't afford another radio. I have this enormous one that's in here,
mm-hmm.
which now is not much good, sort of worn out. Yes, she said, I want one in my room that I can hear all the news every morning when I waken up. And so I said, all right, we'll buy that. And I remember so vividly, it was only, I think, $17. And we've had it every day since she bought it. We've had it there in our little kitchen. Well, this was this first meeting. Then we had to get a permit. And I told you this before. We applied for a permit to have a procession. And the national headquarters, we kept informed up in New York about everything, and they were very anxious for us to have it. They thought it was a very good thing to have this procession. It would have a good effect on the suffrage movement all over the country. But they were always harping on the fact that they couldn't afford to pay a penny toward it. So then we were told by the chief of police, that told us, that they would give us a permit for 16th Street, which is the residence street, perhaps the principal residence street, where all the embassies are nearly, in Washington. And that'd be the suitable background for our procession. And we had asked for Pennsylvania Avenue, having been told by almost everybody we asked that was the political avenue where you always had your processions from the Capitol to the White House, and that no one would pay much attention. We went down 16th Street. So we said we just must have Pennsylvania Avenue, and they said, well, that's fine, we certainly won't let you have it. It's totally unsuitable for women to be marching down Pennsylvania Avenue. And so then Elsie Hill asked her mother, since her father was in Congress, and the Congress supports and raises, gives the money for the district to police and everything else,
mm-hmm.
She thought her mother maybe could do something, so her mother said she would go down and talk to this.
Yeah.
What is the name of that man? Was it Sylvester?
His name was not given in any of the references I read, but whoever the present, the contemporary police chief was at that time.
Whoever he was, I don't remember, but I remember so well that Major Sylvester was my impression that he was the one at that time. Anyway, Mrs. Hill took Elsie Hill with her, and they came out of the interview with the permit for the avenue. So then we had something to work on, and we got up a committee. We divided up into all the different groups. One was to get the nurses, one the doctors, one the lawyers, one the college graduates, and so on. I found here my photograph, just in going through these things, I'll show it to you, when I was in that procession.
Oh, you did? Oh, good.
Just by chance, I found it.
Fine.
That's somebody downstairs?
Yeah, they came in. Your tenant.
Excuse me, one minute, I'll ask if she's the one that's so chilly.
That gets cold all the time, yeah. Yes. I guess the downstairs, too, is always colder than the upstairs, isn't it?
Well, everybody else has thought of it. You heard me ask Charlie. Did you go down and see how it was?
They all said it was warm.
He said it's nice and warm. Well, I was saying that we had these committees for every department, and we succeeded in getting, apparently, from the results, very good chairman leaders in each one. And because, you see, between the 2nd of January and the 3rd of March, wasn't very long to get up a procession in a city where you weren't known,
no.
And where you had no workers, and where you had about every obstacle that you could have.
And you had just moved into your headquarters, I guess?
Well, we hadn't, moved in. Well, maybe we just moved in. But anyway, we had nothing. And we had to raise all the money, and we had to get all the women to march. And so we put somebody in charge of the costumes. This was Hazel Mackay. I don't know if you ever heard of her.
Oh, yes.
You know who...
Benton Mackay.
Benton Mackay is her brother, but the other famous one was Percy Mackay, the painter, the poet. Well, she was considered the foremost pageant worker in America.
Hmm.
And I remember that one day somebody who was working with us said, "He's coming to Washington tomorrow. The best pageant, best woman in the field of pageantry in the country, and it'd be a good thing to get her if we could to help." So we went to her right away when she came, and we became lifelong friends. Until her death, she was always one of our supporters. And so she took over all the pageantry. She put on something on the treasury steps, so that when the procession would go by, they would all see this beautiful pageant on the treasury steps being repeated and repeated. Elsie Hill was one of the dancers, I remember, in this pageant on the treasury steps. And it seems to have been very beautiful. And she had, the whole procession was so colorful. We had one section, then followed by another section, another colors, and another, and another. And
you mean I walked
in the college section, which Elsie Hill led, and each chairman got all her paper for it. She wanted me to walk in her section, so I did. So we each wore cap and gown, and ours was a dark, but very dignified little section. And some of them, the one who had the foreign section, had very colorful costumes for women of different lands. They each brought their own costume. And so it was, I think, was a very successful procession.
Who led the parade?
The National Board of the National American Suffrage Association.
Oh.
Because it was under their auspices, you see.
I see.
We were their committee that got it up.
Yeah.
And then Dr. Shaw, I guess, was the leading person in their board who walked at the head. I think it's Mrs. Mary Ware Dennett and a few of the other people on the board. I don't remember who were there. I remember the National Treasurer was there, the one who was always afraid of sending some bills in.
Yeah.
Her name was Mrs. Stanley McCormick.
Oh.
All these people walked at the head. Well, we went out bright and early. I guess I told you this, too, before, that how we made an arrangement with the people who were selling the tickets. I told you that, didn't I?
Oh, yes. So that.
You want me to tell you over again?
Yeah, please tell me about that.
Well.
These people come to you?
Some group had gotten a contract to sell the tickets, and put up the grandstands and sell all the tickets from the grandstand. I don't know what their contract would like. But For the inaugural procession.
Right. Yeah.
And so then they came to us and asked, since they thought we were going to have a pretty interesting procession the preceding day, if they could make their ticket selling cover our day too. And they would give us a percentage of all the tickets they sold. So we gave them a little tiny space in our little tiny office. And there they had somebody selling tickets. all day long and all night long, all evening long, until the day of the procession. And they took in a great deal of money, and it was one of the big helps in enabling us to pay all the big bills we had for getting this up. So there'd never been a procession of women for any cause in the world, probably in Washington. Nobody had ever seen it. Nobody ever dreamt that women were always seeing these elks and people going around proceeding, processing, yeah. But they never thought of women doing such a thing. Yeah. And so there really was a great interest in it. And a great many tickets were being sold, to our astonishment. So we had a pretty good idea that there'd be a great many people there. Apart from the people who had written to us, they'd come and do the march, beating the march. And we had floats, and a great series of floats, different towns and different sections of the suffrage movement over the country that we would write to would say they would come and they would bring a float and pay for their own float. And the floats were very decorative part, mixed in with this very great pageantry that Hazel Mackay had produced, I think. So when the day came, almost at time for the procession, we found that apparently the police were taking the matter very casually, and they said, well, maybe a handful of police could tend to it on the day before the inaugural, and that then they would concentrate all their force on taking care of the people in the inaugural. And we tried, and with not much success, to get them to think we might have a big procession and they'd better be prepared. So then the night before, as I told you, Mrs. Stimson, sister-in-law, Mr. Stimson's sister-in-law, Mrs. John Rogers, Mrs. Rogers was the sister of Mrs. Stimson. Mrs. Rogers said she would take me down, she was on our committee, and talk to her brother-in-law and see if he couldn't be aroused into the fact that we really were in some doubt as to whether the police could handle the crowds. Mm-hmm. So we went to see him. At the same time, they were having a big mass meeting in the, I think, Constitution Hall, you know, it's a DAR, but I'm not sure, but in one of the big theaters, a big place in Washington. And Mrs. Catt, Carrie Chapman. Well, I mean, I think it was my first, I'm not sure, but I remember going to see Mrs. Catt in New York when I came back, and sometime in the period between when I came back and when I started this movement in Washington, had one talk with Mrs. Catt, and I remember she said to me, I feel that I've enlisted for life. This is something that cannot be done. I cannot get this federal amendment, and it's, I think, and I did this deliberately, knowing I was enlisting for life, and I'm sure she did. She was a very devoted member of the whole movement. So we asked her to come down and speak at this mass meeting. And that's the first time that we ever had any real contact with her. And she came and made a very powerful speech. People told me I didn't go because I was out seeing Mr. Stimson at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you want me to go on or is it stopping?
No, it's doing fine.
So then Mr. Stimson said, why, of course, if the police can't handle it, you can just count on me. I'll send the send over our artillery from this place right outside of Washington, where he was in charge of all the my cavalry. I mean, he said, I'll send over the cavalry, and they'll handle everything you need. He said, just call me up and see if you have any difficulty. If you do have any difficulty, so that relieved our minds very much. So the next morning, when we went out early, very early, to try to begin to line the people up in all the different sections, we had a grand marshal who rode on horseback with several assistant marshals on horseback, but they were more for publicity. They were the chief marshal, grand marshal, was a Mrs. Burleson, and you know at that time there was a Burleson in, I think, in the cabinet of Mr. Wilson. Anyway, she was a prominent, very prominent Texan family, Democratic family. I'm not absolutely sure what her relationship was to Burleson. And her husband was an officer at Fort Myer. So she came in and practiced and rehearsed and everything else and was extremely decorative person with a, on her horse, but you couldn't do much because when we started out to form our people up, we had no place to form because the whole street was just, from one side to the other, was just filled with people. They were tourists, I would say, who had all come to see the inaugural and gotten there the day before. And they were there with their mothers and fathers and children, and just a great mass of people who had no interest except in trying to see a woman's march, and they couldn't any longer buy tickets because they were almost all exhausted, I guess. So when we saw it out, we had this mass of people, and we didn't know how to get through. And we tried to get through, and we just saw it couldn't be done. We could never have this procession of maybe 1,000 women, or 5,000, or what, 10,000, whatever we had, we'd never get them through. So we went to the phone and called Mr. Simpson, and he said that, I don't know who went, well, probably I went, but I don't remember. And he said that, all right, he would do just as he'd agreed the night before, and he'd have the cavalry there as fast as they could get there. So they came, all on their horses, prancing around, and of course they could easily open the way, which they did, so we could go a block maybe, and then the way was all closed again, they'd have to open the next block. So the, as I told you the other night, the march, which was supposed to end in the Constitution Hall at a certain hour, it was hours later before we ever came inside of Constitution Hall. We had the meeting there all right, but on the way, for instance, there was this pageant of Hazel Mackay's, which we'd spent a great deal of effort on, and it was apparently going to be extremely beautiful. So these poor people in the pageant, they had a separate grandstand built, the cellars of this whole thing. Normally, they'd go around in front of the White House processions, but this time they went in the back of it so as to be opposite the Treasury and enable all the people who paid extra to have extra good seats to see the pageant. So all these people thought they were paying extra to be in this place of vantage to see the pageant on the Treasury steps. And we got very good publicity all the time we were getting up this procession, because this Mrs. John and Mrs. Helen Gardner I'd gone to see turned out to be a super whiz at this.
Oh, really?
And she would arrive in the early morning and stay all day long and never budge, and certainly she was 100% wonderful, I thought. Didn't see how anybody could have been better. Well, then?
Well, both Washington papers were faced, too, I guess, with prospects of filling their space between the time of the election and the inauguration.
Maybe.
So maybe you had some good
luck.
Good. Well, also, I mean, you were given newspaper space that...
You see, Mr. McLean, the head of, owner of the Washington Post, gave us $1,000.
Oh, really?
And the...
Then?
I don't know whether he did it for that procession or just after the procession, but he gave it to us. So we had the goodwill of the Post.
Yeah.
That's the first big gift I think we got.
It's a big one.
Well, anyway, we had the cavalry working as hard as they could and very faithfully. And people have written it up, and I would like to read again that hearing. Because Mr. Gallagher tells me how it's written up there is that we were mobbed and people were very antagonistic and so on.
Yeah.
But I didn't get that impression myself. Hmm. My impression is that people of the police doing the best they could and having their leaders not provided enough policemen that they could not possibly, any possible way, manage it. And then...
Well, I have the reference on that congressional hearing which followed.
Have you a copy of it?
I don't have a copy, but Mabel Vernon has a copy.
Has she?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to hope she'll let me have it, because I had two copies, and I left these in the library, and as far as I know, they both disappeared.
Well, Doris Stevens' account intimates some sort of
harassment,
and so does the Irwin account.
I know they do, but Miss Irwin wasn't even a member of ours at that time, nor was Doris Stevens. I don't think...
And of course, the suffragist wasn't being printed at that time, so we don't have
the only land. Place I could see what we testified, because I testified, and I'd like to see what we said in the testimony.
Yeah.
But as I look back on it, no.
You remember the problem.
What?
Go ahead. Excuse me.
I said, as I look back on it, no. My impression is that the police were valiant in their effort to try to keep order, and completely, just as about as completely at loss what to do as we were. And nothing saved us, that nothing saved that procession but Secretary Stimson sending his cavalry, I'm sure of that. And I remember there were some protests from people thinking that the crowd had made remarks or so on they didn't like, but I don't know there was anything more worse than that. I remember Mr. Kent was one of those who wanted this investigation, because his daughter Elizabeth, beautiful, lovely girl, was on the float. That's our Mrs. Kent's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that somebody had pulled her foot or done something like that from the crowd. Something he thought was very insulting.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some people that seemed to think that the crowd had not behaved as they ought to behave, but I wasn't really conscious of it myself. I suppose I was so terribly busy trying to keep the people in line and get them not to go home disheartened, but to keep our own little army together.
Yeah.
But anyway, we finally emerged at Constitution Hall at the end.
Yeah.
And had this meeting. And then immediately, these congressmen that somehow or other had been brought in touch with it, the one I remember the most is Mr. Kent, got this investigation started. And the chairman of it was Senator from Washington State. I guess his women had asked him to do it because Washington already become enfranchised, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember going down to see him in the morning and asking him about it and what we should do and everything. And
I think my dinner's burning in the oven.
He was really enthusiastic, I imagine, because of the women back home. So I went to see whom we should ask to be speakers and testify, witnesses and so on, and what they should do and everything, all the procedure. And then I remember saying to him, well, what, I'll have to come in and see you probably a good many times about this, and what time would you like me to come? And I remember him saying, oh, I'm always beginning my work at 7 in the morning. That's the time to come. And I got a very wonderful impression of senators. I thought, that here they are, all work 7 in the morning. I have a hard time to get my eyes open at 7 in the morning. But when we had this hearing,